Agora. Sarva Shastra Vipyusha Sarva Vedaika Satpala Sarva Siddhanta Ratnadya Sarva Lokaika Drikpada Sarva Bhagavata Prana Srimad Bhagavata Prabhu Kali Dwanto Ditaditya Sri Krishna Parivartita Paramananda Pattaya Prima Varshakshadaya Te Sarvada Sarvasevyaya Sri Krishnaya Namostume Madhika Bandho Matsangin Madguru Madmahadana Madnistaraka Madbhagya Madananda Namostute Asadu Sarutadayin Atinicho Chatakara Hanamuncha Kadachin Mam Premnarit Kantayokspura Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Nishtya Tatosi Bhadram Te Gramyan Kaman Apipsase Udvahishyami Tangsteham Swabandhubir Arindama Tishya Gatosi Bhadram Te Gramyan Kaman Abhipsase Udvahishyami Tangsteham Swabandhubir Arindama
Please chant.
Disya gatosi badram te Gramyan kaman abhipsase Vishyami tamsteham Sabandhubir arindama Tishagatosi Bhadram Te Yam Kaman Abhipsase Udvahishyami Tamsteham Svabandhubir Arindama
Ladies
Tishagatosi Bhadram Te Gramyan Kaman Abhipsase Udvahishyami Tamsteham Svabandhubir Arindama
Ladies
Tishya Gatosi Bhadram Te Gramyan Kaman Abhipsase Udvahishyami tamsteham Sabandhu Biravindamo Tishyagato Sipadram Te Kramyan Kamana Bipsase Udvahishyami Tamstiham Sabandhu Biravindamo Tishyagato Sipadram Te Kamyan Kamana Bipsase Sabandhu Biradindama Tishya.
Fortunately for me,
Agatosi,
you have come here.
Badram,
all auspiciousness,
te,
unto you,
gramyan,
sensual,
kaman,
desired enjoyable objects,
abipsase,
you want to enjoy.
Udvahishyami.
I shall supply.
Tan.
All of them.
Te.
Unto you.
Aham.
I.
Swabandhubihi.
With all my friends.
Arim.
Dhamma, O killer of the enemy. Translation and comment and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O killer of the enemy, you have somehow or other come here. This is certainly great fortune for me. I wish all auspicious things for you. You have a great desire to satisfy your senses. And all my friends and I shall try our best in all respects to fulfill your desires. You know the context. Puranjana has met his intelligence, his material intelligence, and she's going to arrange for him to enter his material body and try to enjoy material life. Prabhupada explains in the purport. The living entity comes down into this material world for sense gratification. And his intelligence, represented by the woman, gives him the proper direction by which he can satisfy his senses to their best capacity. In actuality, however, intelligence comes from the super soul, or the supreme personality of Godhead. And he gives full facility to the living entity who has come down to this material world. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, Vyavasayat mika budhir ekeha kurunandana bahushaka hyanantascha buddhayo vyavasayinam. Those who are on the spiritual path are resolute in purpose, and their aim is one. O beloved child of the Kurus, the intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. When a devotee is advancing towards spiritual realization, his only aim is the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He does not care for any other material or spiritual activity. King Puranjana represents the ordinary living entity. And the woman represents the ordinary living entity's intelligence. Combined, the living entity enjoys his material senses, and the intelligence supplies all paraphernalia for his enjoyment. As soon as he enters the human form, the living entity is entrapped by a family tradition, nationality, customs, etc. These are all supplied by the Maya of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus the living entity, under the bodily conception of life, utilizes his intelligence to his best capacity in order to satisfy his senses. This Srimad Bhagavatam is very important for us, the devotees who have some faith in it, because we accept that it's history, not fiction or mythology. We accept the accounts of the Bhagavatam as literal historical facts. And therefore, the book has very great significance for us. It's describing reality, not just someone's imagination or someone's fanciful opinion. The facts and the opinions stated in the Bhagavatam we can accept as authoritative because we have trust in that. Supposedly, the accounts given of persons who lived at certain times and did various things, they're supposed to be historical facts. But there are a few exceptions in the Bhagavatam, intentional exceptions. There are a few small sections, passages, that are fictional. Narad Muni is responsible for each of those fictional passages. He told one story to the sons of Daksha, the Haryashvas, and then another story to the next generation, next crop of sons, the Shabalashvas. And now he's telling a big story, fictional story, allegory, to King Prachini Bharhishat, who's very materialistic, relatively speaking, compared to the other great saintly kings in his line. He's a big materialist. Compared to people nowadays, he would be a great saint. But he wasn't up to the standard of his forefathers. And he was very attached to ritualistic sacrifices and was implicated in violence against innocent animals because of that. And therefore his intelligence was dull. And Narada could not speak Vedanta philosophy to him. He had to speak in story form, just like Jesus Christ told parables, because the people he was preaching to were not extremely intelligent. So Prachini Bharhishat is not extremely intelligent due to his entanglement in ritualism and in violence. Therefore, Narada is choosing intentionally to tell him a story. Most of it never happened. There are few real people who become characters in the story. Sometimes you see that. Fiction is written, novel or other fiction. And there may be a few real people who appear in the fiction. Narada himself appears. And Sage Agastya, I think, appears in this story. But most of it is just a story. But still, it's very deep truth, because by the vehicle of this story, Narada is telling the facts of life, of material life, to Puranjana, to Prachini Bharhishat. King Paranjana, who's just a fictional character, is every man, everybody in material life. What happened to him has happened to all of us, and will happen to anybody who enters into material life. Everyone consorts with his material intelligence, and his material life begins from that. Just as in regular life, a person's life is simple until he gets married. Then things become complicated. So, in similar fashion, the complications of Paranjana's life begin when he marries his intelligence. And here she is greeting him, alluring him with her words. Women may use their beauty or other skills to attract a mate. But here, intelligence is a subtle force. She uses her poetic expression and the attractive ideas that she's expressing. This is how she's attracting the intelligence of King Paranjana. Intelligence is explained by Kapiladeva and also elsewhere in the second and third cantos. The function of intelligence is to direct the mind. The mind is very unstable. That is the nature of the mind, to constantly change. It's attracted to one thing. It may become repelled to the same thing another moment, or it may shift its attention to some other object of attraction or repulsion. The mind is constantly changing. Therefore, in Shakespeare's play Romeo and Juliet, Romeo is below the balcony of Juliet, serenading her, and he makes some promise that I promise by the moon that I will love you forever. And she remarks, swear not by the inconstant moon. What's the use of promising by the moon? You'll always love me. The moon is changing from one day to the next. The moon is inconstant because it is ruled by the mind. The moon is the controlling planet of the mind. And the mind is always unstable. Left to itself, a person who's on the mental platform can never make up his mind. He can never accomplish anything substantial in life because he gets an idea and then changes his idea back and forth, one thing to another, and never accomplishes anything. Only when a person has strong intelligence can he accomplish anything in life, material or spiritual. Paranjana is getting his intelligence, and therefore he's going to become a great king, ruler of the city of nine gates, and he's going to go out and make conquests and collect friends and develop influence far and wide and enjoy for his few years. And it's all on the basis of establishing contact with his material intelligence. So this is actually a function of the mode of passion. Intelligence works in the mode of passion. Even though it's higher than the mind, it's assigned to the lower mode because that is the way intelligence works. It pushes us. When we make up our mind by our intelligence, we're pushed very strongly in a particular direction in life. We decide to make something a goal, and we aim for it very intently. That is how intelligence works. It fixes the direction of the mind by setting a goal. But the goal can be anything. in yoga practice, in Ashtanga yoga, there is gradual development of control of the life of the physical organs, and then by asanas, then control of the air of life, the breath, by pranayama, then control of the senses by pratyahara, withdrawing them from unnecessary engagements, and the next step is dharana, and that is fixing intelligence. Dharana is actually, I think, the sixth step, and it's the last step in Ashtanga yoga for which there is a particular sadhana or practice. After that, in the last two stages, the development is spontaneous. Meditation and trance, there's no way to practice them. You just graduate to them and they develop naturally. But the last phase of Ashtanga yoga, which has a sadhana, is dharana. And that is fixing the mind on one point by the exercise of intelligence. But generally, in the textbooks on this yoga, it's proposed that it doesn't matter what you fix your mind on. It can be anything. But just practice to fix the mind. Whatever object you find convenient and attractive, fix your mind on that. And that's the way intelligence functions. It can be aimed at a very elevated and transcendental goal, or it can be aimed at the most gross and corrupt goal, or a harmful goal. So thus the difference between good intelligence and bad intelligence is the quality of the object that it focuses on. Krishna, Prabhupada quotes Krishna's statement in the second chapter of the Gita, Vyavasayatmika buddhir ekeha kurunandana. There's two kinds of exercise of intelligence. There's resolute intelligence. I think everybody knows the word resolute. It's not used that much in contemporary English. Prabhupada likes to use old poetic language. But resolute means with firm determination, that you're going to direct yourself toward a goal and not let yourself be deviated or obstructed. That is resolution. Just like we make New Year's resolutions. You promise you're going to do something, give up smoking cigarettes or whatever. That a resolution is just words, but to carry it out, you need resolve. You need the power of determination. One kind of intelligence is vyavasayatmika, resolute intelligence that is determined, is strong. It is not easily thwarted. And Krishna says that is ekeha. A person with resolute intelligence has a single goal. He's coherent in his direction. That can be actually spiritual or material coherence. You can be resolute in a very harmful goal, a very degraded goal, or in a perfect spiritual goal. But then there are other people. Everyone has intelligence. Even a dog, a cat, or an ant has intelligence. The ant, they don't just wander aimlessly. They aim at goals. One ant smells a lump of sugar, and all the ants fix their intelligence. We're going to get that sugar. Whether it means marching hundreds of miles, according to ant measurement, and carrying loads that are several times the weight of their own bodies, whether it means sacrificing their lives, they're going to get that sugar. So they're fixing their intelligence. That's vyavasayatmika buddhi on a certain level. But then there are other people, although everybody has some capacity of intelligence. Every living being has intelligence. The amoebas have their intelligence. But some people's intelligence is resolute, and some people's intelligence is very soft and not solidly directed. So, bahushaka yanantascha buddhayo avyavasayinam. Those, how is Prabhupada translated? The intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. Intelligence doesn't really accomplish its purpose when it's not firm. To work, intelligence has to be firm. Just like if you want to shoot arrows from a bow, you have to hold the bow firmly. You can't hold it irresolutely, then you cannot direct the arrow. The arrow can go anywhere. But if you hold the bow firmly, even though a lot of pressure and force is being applied, you hold the bow very firmly, and then you can aim properly at your target. Similarly, intelligence has to be firm to actually be effective in reaching a goal. If it's not firm, then it cannot properly control the mind. Then the mind is out of control. And therefore, it said that the intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. Because the mind is actually left to control one's life. One lives on the mental platform. And from one minute to the next, one day to the next, he's changing his intentions. So, King Paranjana, he represents the living entity who is very resolute in his pursuit of material enjoyment. Basically, every living entity is, but especially those who are influenced by the mode of passion, they're going to be very much affected, very much impelled by material intelligence. And to some extent, more or less, every one of us is King Paranjana. We have voluntarily, no one forced us, we have voluntarily chosen to consort with our material intelligence. We entered this matrimonial connection with our intelligence of our own accord. Krishna didn't force us to do it. Our theology does not put the blame on God. We're in this material world. We fell down from our original spiritual condition by our own choice. No one forced us to pick up this connection with material intelligence and to pursue irrelevant and self-destructive goals, the goals of material life. All of them, all material purposes, are irrelevant to the real aim of our purpose of our life, and they're all harmful to us. Therefore, our theology is to be opposed completely to material life. We don't compromise. Narada certainly is not a compromiser in this way. Whoever he preaches to, materialist or great saint, to all of his disciples, he preaches uncompromisingly rejection of material life in all its aspects. It's all irrelevant and harmful. All aspects, all pursuits of material life, no matter what they are. Therefore, Narada here in narrating this allegory is speaking in very general terms. He doesn't have to be specific. No matter what in particular Paranjana is actually doing in his life, and when you get down to the real Paranjana, he's got specific goals in his life. He's trying to make money, or he's trying to make friends, or he's looking for security or health. He's looking for something in particular. But that doesn't matter. It's all the same story. No matter what the individual particular goals are, it's all just pursuit of illusion, of what Prabhupada boils down to the simple term sense gratification. People think they all are such great individualists, and they all have their own tastes and their own opinions and their own goals, but actually everyone's doing the same thing, pursuing sense gratification
in one form or another. So this is the story of every man, Paranjana. We should be aware that this story is not being told just for Prachini Parishad. It's being told for us. This is our story also. Even here we are seriously engaged in the practice of devotional service, still our conditioning has not, at least in some of our cases, has not yet completely been dispelled. We still have our material goals. We still have our material desires, and we may even actively be engaged in pursuing them. So that means we're still in the position of Puranjana, voluntarily consorting with material intelligence. Our philosophy tells us that this is illusion, and that to actually become successful in life, we have to reject and put aside this illusion. Prabhupada talks in the second paragraph of the purport about the spiritual intelligence that serious devotees of the personality of Godhead develop. Prabhupada says, when a devotee is advancing towards spiritual realization, his only aim is the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In mixed devotional service, karma mishra bhakti, jnana mishra bhakti, yoga mishra bhakti, one is in part aiming at Krishna and in part also still aiming at something material. That's the nature of mixed devotional service. You want Krishna, you may want liberation, but you don't want them wholeheartedly. You still have material goals. But that's not pure devotional service. That's impure devotional service. And it's not up to our standard. It doesn't accomplish the real purpose. Serious pursuit of pure devotional service means that your only aim is the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There can't be competing aims. That is the level of bahushaka hanantascha, irresolute intelligence. To be successful in material life, in business, or in politics, or other serious material pursuits, a person has to be resolute. You're not going to make a lot of money without fixing your determination. You're not going to win in politics without being very determined. And in the same way, we're not going to be successful in Krishna consciousness without also being resolute. Ultimately, having no other aim than the pleasure and the glorification of Krishna. Everything we were previously taking very seriously in material life, we have to put that in proper perspective. We may still have to make money. We may still have to maintain a family. Or even a brahmachari has some material obligations. He has to wash his clothes. He has to take a shower. He has to eat. Even a brahmachari or a sannyasi has some material obligations. He has to deal with other people in his preaching work. These are various obligations. But we have to put these material things in perspective. They have to more and more recede into the dim background of our shadow life, which is not the reality. The reality is the single-pointed aim of Krishna's glorification and his pleasure. We should be living only for that. Everything else is, at best, just secondary. Paranjana's story is being told by Narada to tell Prachini Parishat what he's doing wrong and what not to continue. But the opposite side of the coin is resolute determination in Krishna consciousness aiming just at Krishna and his pleasure. That is what we have to replace our material intelligence with. Intelligence is a natural function of the soul. Material intelligence is a covering, but our original intelligence is part of our spiritual makeup. It cannot be eliminated. Intelligence cannot be eliminated. It may be masked or made dysfunctional, but it's always there, no matter what condition of life we're in, no matter what consciousness we're in. So what's recommended in the process of Krishna consciousness is to rectify intelligence, to transform it into our real, true, original spiritual intelligence, and to be very, if we can say passionately, although not in the material sense, intent on becoming successful in Krishna consciousness by doing what Krishna wants, as we understand from the instructions of our spiritual masters. That's ultimately what Narada is trying to explain to King Purcheni Barishat. Hare Krishna. So, are there any questions or comments? Yes. Due to Karmapur.
So, you were mentioning in the beginning of your talk that we take, you know, the Bhagavatam as history, not mythology, or something. So, why? Why do we do that? I mean, who says? Or.
Vedyam vastam amatra vastu. Vyasadeva in the very first or second verse says that. First verse. Vedyam vastam amatra vastu. The subject matter, vastu. Vastu means the storyline. The message. The message of the Bhagavatam is vastavam. It's dealing with reality, not with fantasy or just opinion. Plato, you know, the founder of modern Western philosophy, or Western philosophy, he made a distinction between doxia and knowledge, between knowledge and just opinion. Everybody's got opinions, but only a real philosopher or scientist has connection with reality. That he knows, he doesn't just imagine or believe. So it's essential for us. We have to establish connection with reality, not just have opinions or beliefs, or listen to other people's opinions and beliefs. So the whole purpose we have of accepting these scriptures and studying them is that we're taking them as revelation of higher reality, not just some cultural phenomena of the beliefs of some people who lived a long time ago, but actual scientific and historical presentation of reality. That's the purpose of Shastra. That's what Shastra means. It's something that teaches you what's real. Is that okay? Yeah. We'll follow up on the question.
Yes. They mentioned this particular story that we're considering now.
Yes.
Is an allegory. So what kind of truth is there in allegory? And how, and
analogical,
someone asked, well, if there is allegory, how do we know that other things aren't allegories in the Bhagavatam?
Yes. Well, we accept the opinions of the commentators, Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath. They're telling us which few episodes of the Bhagavatam are just fiction. You know, it's their opinions that we're taking. And we're taking their opinions as authoritative. And then how do you derive fact from a fiction? There's a poetic device called Artha Antara Nyasa,
where you introduce an apparently irrelevant topic in the middle of a shloka or in the middle of a narration, but it actually explains the thing that would be otherwise be hard to understand. For Paranjana, because he's such a materialist, to be told in philosophical terms would be beyond his capacity to grasp. Therefore, he's being told in story form. The very general story, it's actually a very universal story of Paranjana. He's nobody in particular, he's everybody. That's one mode of Artantara Nyasa. You use a very general statement to clarify a specific statement. Like some king is being told, don't trust what your wife is saying. You know, if you do what she says, you'll get in trouble. And then to explain that, it's said, women are always like this. So a general statement can be used to make more easily understandable a very specific situation. So Parchiti Barishat, he's got his individual problems in life. He's too materialistic, he's too ritualistic, he's not interested in actual spiritual life. So in order to correct his misunderstanding, Narada is explaining things in very universal terms in the story of every man. Anyway, it's a rhetorical device that you can explain the specific by general or vice versa. I don't know if that clarifies it enough, but the best I can say.
Hare Krishna. Yes. Just because you're here and the devotees who are here can always ask you outside, I'd like to just interject. There's one question from the internet, because your class is broadcast over the internet.
So okay.
This person, a young man named William, wants to know, how can an aspiring devotee lose fear of completely engaging himself in devotional service?
Lose fear of completely engaging himself in devotional service. Not everybody has so much that problem that they're afraid to dive into devotional service. If someone like that needs support, encouragement, and maybe someone to hold his hand. So to have a good relationship with a strong or more than one or more strong spiritual guides, and to see their examples, how so-and-so, without hesitation took complete shelter of Krishna, and look what a success he is. So to see the examples and to have the personal relationship with strong devotees, that's what someone who's fearful about surrendering, what he needs to do: get good association and see the good examples. There has to be some good association available and some good examples. If we can't provide that, then we're not going to be able to do much for these hesitant people who are attracted but are hesitant. We have to show good examples and give association. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Prabhu, for a nice class. It was explained that the material intelligence is inviting King Purushottam to enter to enjoy.
Yes.
So, at every step of our life, in every moment, it seems like every second we're making choices.
Yes.
To enjoy or not to. So I was seeing that, for example, for a hungry man, if you put a pizza or a, like any favorite dish, he will go for it immediately. He wouldn't even consider about his intelligence. He just wants to eat.
Because he's hungry, yes.
So, the living entity being a marginal, he makes his choice to either enjoy or not. Where does he get the intelligence to actually go for this thing? If there will be Narada Muni right there at the spot in the beginning, and say, and Narada Muni will be there right there at the first choice that we make and say, if you do this, this will happen to you. Don't do it.
But a person who's addicted to enjoyment, even Narada Muni will come to him and tell him, don't do it. And here's the reasons why. The person who's too addicted won't be able to accept it. and follow it. Even Narada Muni or some great soul is telling him. So in order to be able to develop spiritual intelligence and resolute spiritual intelligence, we have to curb, we have to bring under control and minimize our material addictions. As long as someone is the slave of his intelligence, material intelligence, he's not going to be free to begin to actually develop his spiritual intelligence. There has to be some renunciation, some sense of detachment developed before one can become serious about Krishna consciousness. Various ways for that to happen. Krishna can, Maya can arrange for complete frustration and disaster in one's life that he's forced to give up his attachments. Or he just develops philosophical understanding, or someone convinces him. There are various ways. But it has to be done. We have to loosen up our attachments before we can become serious in real spiritual life. Yes, Mother? Sorry, can we put the microphone here?
Hare Krishna. Yes. You said that the story about the King Paranjana was told as a story because the people that the information was given weren't that intelligent, so they would absorb the information better if it was told like a... Then, with that logic, how can we not know for sure that when first they tried to bring this religion to Western civilization, because people are ambitious and hardworking and achieving things, and they just couldn't. They just came back and saying it's impossible to do this in the Western civilization. And then later Prabhupada came when he was 69 and started spreading this in the 70s. So how can we not know that then his teacher didn't tell him that, tell them some of the stories as huge as possible. There was huge snakes and half man, half eagle, and the hills being carried in the air. So, and tell these stories like it happened, so it's going to be more effective, because these people are not that intelligent and they're not going to get this religion unless we give them like a fact. I'm asking with all due respect, but then at one point, like, where do you draw the line? Like, could they have seen us as less intelligent people because we are more achievers, and someone coming from a poor country, coming from a village, is not like that great a big achievement to be completely renunciate, as opposed to someone who has set goals and achieved things in their entire life. And is it not possible to be both, like having a great spiritual life and also being happy in the normal lifetime with their families and their professions? Because in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells to Arjuna that you don't have to give up your profession because he's a Kshatriya, and accept this, because Arjuna didn't want to fight. And I said, I want to accept you and just follow you. I don't want to do this.
Yes.
And Krishna said, this is your job. You don't have to give up your profession, your career, to be Krishna conscious. And can people living outside the temple not be just as Krishna conscious as the people living inside, not giving up their professions? Because Krishna says you don't have to. So.
Okay, you're asking two different things here. First of all, about how do we know that the whole Bhagavatam isn't just a bunch of stories. That Prabhupada didn't just make up some stories because we're materialists here in the West. Well, the thing is, Prabhupada didn't make up the stories. The stories about the big snakes and everything else are there in the Bhagavatam, which is thousands of years old. So it wasn't some new stories that were made up just for the Western materialists, but the very spiritually cultured, the strong spiritual culture of India going back thousands and millions of years, these stories, these narrations of the Bhagavatam and other Puranas and other scriptures go back into the context of ancient India, where people were much more civilized. There were actually really intelligent people back then. Even 100 years ago, you could find pundits, who would assemble an audience and let 100 people ask 100 different questions and then answer all of them right. And from memory recite hundreds and thousands of shlokas, and even nowadays a few scholars, pundits in India who have that kind of intelligence. What to speak of thousands of years ago? There were actually intelligent people who were actually living civilized, self-controlled lives. And these stories go back that far. It's not, they're not something that Prabhupada made up when he came to America. Prabhupada just narrated the, you know, gave us the Krishna book and the Bhagavatam, which are the old stories that go back thousands of years. And these stories were accepted by very intelligent, reputable, self-controlled, you know, elevated people. It's one thing you make up stories for foolish people, but if very intelligent, you know, practical people accept them, then maybe they're not just stories. You know, so we, one reason to accept the authority of the Bhagavatam and other Vedic literatures is that very intelligent, respectable people did accept for thousands of years. Okay, that's the first question. The second one is about can't householders just, you know, continue their material life and spiritual life both at the same time? What's wrong with that? It depends on the situation. What's appropriate for one person is not appropriate for another. What's appropriate for one person at one time is not going to be appropriate at a different time. Okay, Arjuna was told by Krishna, just, you know, fight, be a kshatriya. Krishna discouraged Arjuna from taking, from renouncing just before the battle. Not the right time to renounce. So Krishna told Arjuna not to renounce. But look at the end of the story. After the battle, 30 years later, when Krishna was ready to leave this planet, he left the planet. He arranged for his whole dynasty, the Vrishnis, to leave. And Yudhishthira understood immediately that Krishna wants us to leave now. So Krishna wanted Arjuna and his brothers to rule the dynasty, to become the prominent leaders of the whole human society, and to act as kshatriyas and householders for so many years. So for Krishna, they accepted the kingdom and everything with it. They accepted their family attachments, and they pursued them properly. But the minute, the very minute that Krishna gave the sign that now it's time to give it all up, immediately Yudhishthira responded positively. Yes. Without talking to anybody, he didn't even consult with his brothers. He immediately took off his royal garments and his ornaments, and that night he left, you know, for the north, meaning, you know, marching off to the northern direction, ready to leave your body. And his brothers and even their wife followed. So the minute that Krishna showed by signs that it's time to give everything up, they were ready to give it up. They accepted it, all these material things for Krishna, and they gave them all up immediately when Krishna wanted that. So it depends on the situation. The same devotee who can, in one phase of his life, should be encouraged to be a good grihastha, another time, there may come the time when he's told to take sannyas. Different things are appropriate for different people or the same person at different times. Okay? Yeah. Okay, I think we should stop now. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.